I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and joining us now on the line from Lexington, Massachusetts, is retired Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor, formerly the United States Marine Corps. And, General, good to talk to you again.
Hi, Neil.
There have been extraordinary developments over the past few days in Baghdad, and particular, what do you make of what started out, or at least was described to us earlier today, as a raid by three battalions of the 3rd Infantry Division who have apparently elected to stay?
Well, they put the raid in the other day, I think, to test the waters, to see what sort of reaction they would get from the Iraqis, and also to see if they could intercept any command and control communications. It was a probing action. I think what we saw most recently, which involved both the Marines and rather the Army and the Marines, that seems to be a little more deliberate. I think they found out pretty much what they wanted to know, which I believe, as near as I can gather, that the defense is not a coordinated and a coherent defense. So I think the movement that we have seen is probably going to be a little more permanent. They will probably pull some of the units out, readjust some of the positions, come in from a different direction. But I think what you're seeing right now is, in fact, the battle for Baghdad.
And it's interesting what you talk about command and control and communications, that this first raid, the one you were talking about on Saturday, was, in fact, to hope that commanders would suddenly get on their radios and start to talk to each other.
Yes, that's basically it. I think they wanted to find out, in a primary sense, do they have a coherent defense for Baghdad, a planned defense where there is a commander who can adjust his positions, adjust his priorities of fire, and so forth. And the way to do that is to prod them and get them to come up on the net or come up on their telephone lines, whatever they may have, and for us to intercept and find out how much control they had. Now, we don't know what the answer to that was, but given the fact that we have moved so quickly thereafter, and what appears to be in a more vigorous fashion and perhaps even a more permanent fashion, in other words, holding the territory that we get, I think the answer was that they probably found out that the command and control had broken down within the regime, and that what you have are singular pockets of resistance that are not mutually supporting and that can be taken out one by one.
In that regard, what General Myers was saying at this briefing we just finished listening to about command and control of the Republican Guard units, that they seem to be unable to provide anything other than sporadic, limited attacks, that would seem to go along with just what you were saying.
Yeah. Now, you have to understand, Neil, that the Republican Guard, and there were the 6 divisions of the Republican Guard, they were responsible for the defense of the approaches to Baghdad. And there were 3 Republican Guard divisions that were covering the southern approaches. The other 3 were up in the north, and they're kind of out of the game at this particular time. The 3 Republican Guard divisions that were defending the approach were pretty well destroyed and made combat ineffective, so that the only thing you'd have left are stragglers, and I don't think the regime was counting on them to do very much. The 3 that are in the north, from Tikrit and on up to the Kirkuk Mosul area, they are being attacked from the air, and they are going to be decimated also. If they stay put, they're going to be destroyed. If they move, they're going to be destroyed. So that brings us to what's available in Baghdad. What's available in Baghdad, and has always been there, were the Special Republican Guard. That was the 4 brigades, accounting for about 15,000 to 20,000 men, relatively lightly on. They were an armored unit, although they do have some armor. But mostly they were for internal security, including internal security against the Iraqi army and possibly even the Republican Guard. So they are the ones in there. They're all Sunnis. They're all part of the Tikriti tribal group that Saddam Hussein comes from. So they are in there. In addition to that, they have some of these irregular units, such as the Fedayeen Saddam, who we were introduced to in their little citadels and the various cities along the supply route coming up from Kuwait to Baghdad, and where some of them are still holding out. And on top of that, he had a variety of militia units of volunteers, lightly armed and not well trained. Now that's what they're facing in Baghdad right now, and these people will probably be more formidable in their defense than the Republican Guards or the regular army, because they have direct ties to the Ba'athist regime. And in amongst them, you may also have some of these, what I would call a foreign legion. These are allies of Saddam Hussein in spirit, coming from various Arab countries. The Marines already came into a group of those and commented that they put up tougher resistance than the Iraqis themselves. So you have a hodgepodge of defenders of that ilk, closely tied to Saddam Hussein, who are in Baghdad and will be putting up whatever resistance there's going to be.
Given those forces and given the disparity in the combat power of the two forces, if one group is able to mobilize and the other one really isn't, do you now anticipate the kind of block-to-block fighting through Baghdad that so many people feared?
Well, it could happen, but I think it would happen more by accident. You'll probably get a couple of incidents like that. But I think we have a pretty good, the U.S. military has a pretty good fix on where the Iraqis are going to be that would put up a defense. Basically, if I can use it in this fashion, Baghdad can be divided into what I would describe as a blue zone, a red zone, and a gray zone. The blue zone would be areas where I think special forces people have indicated that the Americans would be welcome. These would be particularly the Shia regions of Baghdad. There's one in the western section called Saddam City,
mm-hmm.
And that's Shia. And I think there's the feeling that you go in there, you're going to be welcome. Then the red area would be where you got the hardline Sunni Tikriti crowd, where you're liable to get considerable resistance, and then you get the what I call the gray area, and there it's a mixed bag as to what the response will be. So if you lay that out on the map, then you know where you have to go and to get support and where you're liable to get a fight. And so if they don't have a coordinated and a coherent defensive program, which apparently they don't have, what you're doing is dealing with isolated situations which can be reduced one by one. Some of them may involve some very fierce fighting in close quarters, which would in a large measure neutralize some of our heavy equipment. But in terms of the city going over to a block-by-block destruction in the sense that we think of a battle like Stalingrad, that's just not going to happen.
The other question that so many people will have, particularly as we also hear reports of hospitals in Baghdad being overwhelmed by the number of casualties and they're running out of ability to keep up with operations and anesthetic and that sort of thing, is this sort of thing can last for a while, can't it?
Well, it can, but I think what you're going to see is they will be able to isolate pockets of resistance which may be spotted around Baghdad. In the meantime, the reconstitution of Baghdad and the return to normalcy will be going on elsewhere.
I remember talking with some guys who drove tanks in Desert Storm, and they said one of the most dangerous periods for them and what they worried about the most, these were junior officers, was the idea that, you know, relaxing once it seemed to be over, that they thought would be the most dangerous moment.
Oh, there's no question about that. You know, it's axiomatic in the military that once you've taken your objective, that's the most dangerous time because the enemy is going to counterattack. So they've drilled into the heads of the military that once you've taken your objective, be on your toes because your opposition is likely to try and come back and bushwhack you.
And similarly, you know, watching those lines of supply, which were so alive with sporadic attacks a week ago, those seem to have calmed down considerably.
Yeah, it's very. I think this is the thing that caught the administration by surprise, and I think led to a lot of that the complaining back and forth that they didn't have enough forces in there and so forth. I think the basic assumption was that attacking from Kuwait into southern Iraq, which was the Shia area, which rose up against Saddam Hussein in 1991, that we would be welcomed, and that the danger to the long supply line would be minimal, and probably could be taken care of out of the resources of the attacking units, instead of having a separate, say, an armored cavalry regiment or something to secure the supply lines, which is kind of the normal doctrinal thing to do. But they didn't take into account of what Saddam Hussein's counter strategy was. He knew that he couldn't face us toe to toe, so he had to look, what's the American vulnerability? Well, the vulnerability for an armored force which consumes lots of resources is to cut their supply lines. So he embedded in what I call a citadel strategy, he embedded his Fedayeen Saddam, these irregular forces, very, very well equipped. All of these towns that have been taken along the supply line coming up the Euphrates have enormous arsenals of weapons and equipment. So he turned each one of them into a citadel and manned them with these Fedayeen troops, who had two functions. One function was to maintain security of the town and make sure that the Ba'athist regime remained in iron control, and their other function was to try to cut and harass the supply lines mm-hmm. of the Americans so that they were short of supplies on the pointy end of the spear. Now, did they manage to do that? Well, I think they took us a little bit by surprise. We didn't expect it to happen, but there was a counter to it. What we did was avoided the towns themselves, went around them, and then dropped off forces to deal with the local situation. It slowed things down again a bit, but it was temporary, and probably the sandstorm was probably a bigger problem to supply support than the Fedayeen were. Mm-hmm. Subsequent, of course, to the move to Baghdad, we brought in more forces to secure the lines of communication, and I think that's under control now. I don't think there's any problem other than minor annoyances and occasional ambush. I mean, the forces have moved so quickly, and the number of casualties are surprisingly low. This has been a very successful operation.
As we just have a minute left with you, General Traynor, but wanted to ask, one of the things you always look at is, what is the enemy capable of doing that I'm not thinking of? At this point, are there options for Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi military forces?
Well, Neil Ruff, in the beginning, I kept putting on my enemy hat and trying to read it, and if I was the enemy commander, what could I do under the conditions that are apparently existed? And his options have diminished dramatically. When we went into the so-called red zone, which was that radius of about 50 miles around Baghdad in all directions, if he was going to conduct a successful defense, it would have been in there. If he was going to use chemical weapons, that's where he would have used them, and he didn't do it. And his units were destroyed piecemeal on the way to Baghdad. So right now, the best he can do is just have these harassment battles and little groups within Baghdad holding out and trying to inflict as many casualties as possible. It's a dying strategy. There's nothing that he has in terms of a significant capability. The only thing that he can do up in the north in the Kirkuk Mosul area is possibly try to set the oil fields on fire up there, but I don't think that's going to happen. So I think once Baghdad is reasonably taken and occupied, I think this thing will come to an end rather quickly.
General Traynor, thanks very much.
Okay, Neil.
Bernard Traynor, a retired Lieutenant General of the United States Marine Corps, with us from Lexington, Massachusetts. During the news conference we heard just a few minutes ago, Richard Myers, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was asked about reports that military personnel had found sites with chemical weapons in Iraq. Those reports included nerve and blister agents. He declined to comment on any specific finds. I think that was actually the Secretary of Defense who declined to not comment, but said military exploitation teams had responded to a number of reports. Joining us now is NPR's John Hamilton. John, good of you to be with us. How will we know whether the things that they found are really chemical weapons?
Well, there's several different levels of testing. You have the initial reports will come from very primitive forms of testing, something actually not much more complicated than litmus paper. There are pieces of paper that you can expose to these agents, and they will turn colors and give you some idea what you're dealing with, but not terribly accurate. The next level is they do have mobile labs, and there are, although they won't say where, there are a number of labs in the area that are much more sophisticated and can do much better tests. The some of those labs are equipped with gas chromatography, which is a sort of a chemical fingerprinting. And what you would do is actually get a sort of fingerprint of whatever it is you're dealing with and match it with the chemical fingerprint of known agents, say a nerve agent or something, and see how closely it matches.
Mm-hmm. Given the skepticism, and the Secretary and the General were asked about that as well, and we just have a minute here left, John. But given the skepticism, they were asked about chain of command. Hopefully these would be tested by people, independent experts, to validate what they are?
Certainly, if you want to have any credibility, you would have to make sure that the find was observed by other people, probably the media, that you know where that agent is taken, and that it was tested by labs not just from the U.S., but from other countries as well.
So some use, for example, of the same labs that would have tested finds taken by U.N. weapons inspectors.
That's where the system was developed, yes.
NPR's John Hamilton here with us in Studio 3A. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Again, these are just preliminary, unconfirmed reports that substances testing positive as some aspects of chemical weapons have been found in Iraq. Stay tuned to National Public Radio throughout the day as we will continue to bring you up to date on these and the other developments and see if there can be confirmation of those reports of the discovery of weapons of mass destruction. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.